So it's a real pleasure for me to introduce Scott. I think what you're going to find, he's a very non-emotional individual. You're right. We'll start that over. I thought my voice was enough. It's a real pleasure for me to introduce my brother-in-law, Scott. I think what you'll find, he's a very non-emotional person. And those of you who know him, you know that's not true. So we're probably going to see some emotion up here, but it's always wonderful to see this, the rawness of emotion that people get up and share their testimonies and just their openness and honesty and vulnerability. And when I met Scott, he was about 20 years old, long-haired hippie, and we would have some spiritual conversations. And Scott was very argumentative, you know, like, hey, man, Jesus might be black. And I said, well, I don't think Jesus is black. But and just every time we were, you know, and eventually I just told Terry, I said, I'm not doing this anymore. God doesn't need me to defend him. I'm not sure I'm doing a very good job. It's not moving the needle with Scott, but I can't move the needle with Scott anyway. So I did, you know, what would you do next? Maybe you might start praying for the man. So I started praying. Terry and I were praying for him. And honestly, I said to God, I don't know about this one. I don't know how you're going to work this deal out, because I don't see it happening. But it did, and it was pretty amazing to watch, because God is at work all the time, and we don't get to see a lot of the work. But when someone's ready to come to Christ, I mean, it happens like that. And because God's been preparing that heart to receive his son and to receive forgiveness. And that's what I got to witness with Scott. I got to be with him. And it was just an amazing time that God gave the two of us together. So it's all yours, man.
Hi. I want to pray real fast, if that's okay. Dear Heavenly Father, just let me get through this. Amen. Hi, my name is Scott, as Gary said. I think most of you know me, if not, Scott Hall. And I want to thank you for the opportunity today to share my story with you. Hopefully you can hear me. Hopefully something I say today will be meaningful or thoughtful to you. And I'm going to warn you, like Gary did, I'm not emotional. So this is going to be very dry and boring. Because I don't want to sound like a cat in heat, okay? And I don't want any bobcats jumping out of the woods looking for their young. So I'm going to probably pause. To keep it together. And I'll try to honor your time, but I can't guarantee that. So if you get hungry, maybe take off, okay? Because I don't know if I can stick to 30 minutes. Sorry, Gary. But let's go, huh? Here we go. Gloves on, keep it clean. Let's get ready to rumble. I've been married to my wife for 24 years. We've been blessed with three children.
Hey, Abigail.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks a lot. Abigail, 21, Caleb, 19, and Zachary, 13. We live in Cyprus, right in the same neighborhood as my sister Terry. I'm sure you're able to deduce that. And my brother-in-law Gary. Today I'm going to talk about drifting, and I'm going to use the Disney movie Cars to illustrate that thought about drifting, specifically in the movie, if you recall, where Lightning McQueen begins to drift off the highway, and he ends up in a place where he didn't know existed, and a place that he never thought he would be. So my home life when I was young was fragmented at best. Memories for me are limited and sporadic. It's like when you draw on a sticky note, you draw little stick figures and you flip them with your thumb to make a little movie. That's how my memories are, limited and sporadic. I have two sisters, Terry and Diane, and they have a different father than me, but they're my sisters, and if you tell me different, I'll fight you. I have no memories of my father. No foundation. No understanding, nothing. I was told by my mother that he died of a heart attack when I was 2 years old. That turned out to be a lie. Hang on to that, because that's juicy. We'll come back to it. It's good stuff. I had no understanding the role of parents. Terry and Diane moved out when they were close to 18, and my mother and I bounced around from house to house until we settled in Boa Vista, right down by Galveston. And I lived there during my formative years, 6 to 7, till high school. And my life was not terrible here. It's where I started to learn the lack of boundaries and the perceived freedom of no consequences. My mother was around, but she just wasn't present. I suppose because she was single and she was trying to hold everything together like the proverbial plate spinner at the carnival. She was working in Houston, commuting back and forth. And I assume she was trying to have a life of her own during this time, her dreams, her aspirations, her desires. I have no idea. With such little supervision that I had, I would do most everything on my own. I would go to school on my own. I would get home on my own. I would hang out and play in the afternoon on my own. And I would just wait for her to return from work. I played sports, baseball, had friends, attended parties, went roller skating. Really, most of the things I thought I wanted, but there was no structure. No structure and absolutely no discipline. I think most kids crave structure and order. Example, most days when my friends were playing, when we were playing outside, they would go home to their families, and I would be left alone and not knowing what to do next. I didn't know when my mother would be home and from work, because it seemed to change on a nightly basis. But I did know the way our headlights looked on our car. And I would stand down at the end of the road, looking down the road in anticipation for the car to turn on our road, because that would signal that she was almost home. But car after car would turn, and it wasn't her. And finally, you know, she would come home finally, but again, it was just no structure. And I longed for structure. And mix that with my daily unknowns of the schedule, of dinner. We didn't sit down and have dinner. I didn't sit down and do my homework. I didn't sit down and talk to my mother. This was the genesis of my lifelong struggle with anxiety. A battle formed between me desiring structure and the enticing nature of self-governance. No boundaries. No consequence, no repercussions. Little by little, this began to feed the monster of my flesh, and I began to love the lack of oversight. Needless to say, there was no spiritual training during this time. In movies, they have these things called Easter eggs.
I didn't want to do it.
In movies, they have these little things called Easter eggs, little items of foreshadowing and hints. And in all my vignettes as a kid, alcohol was around. As far back as I can remember, alcohol was there. I can still smell the bottle of Michelob my mom would have in her car when she drove around. I can still smell it like it was yesterday. One night, I woke up and mom was not at home. She wasn't in her bed. She wasn't in the kitchen. And I happened to look out across her backyard in Boa Vista. We have these canals. And I looked out and I saw her car in the ditch sideways. And I saw police cars. And I just waited for her to get home. And the sheriff dropped her off at home. And I could tell she was drunk, obviously. But there were no consequences. Not that I saw. She wasn't arrested. Didn't go to jail. Nothing. That was interesting to me. And maybe promising. I was 14 the first time I got drunk. It was with theater kids I met in high school. From the moment I was introduced to theater, I loved it. I love acting. I really do. You can live someone else's life for 2 to 3 hours. And through theater, I found a way to escape. I guess I was good at it because I was accepted to an acting conservatory in St. Louis. The freedom from consequence I had nurtured when I was young did me zero good in college. Alcohol turned to marijuana and even harder drugs. Needless to say, I did not graduate and I came back home. Something happened to my mother while I was away. Seemed like the waves of life was just eroding her, and she began to give up really on everything. Keeping up the home, keeping up the finances, disregarding her health, fully submersing herself in a victim lifestyle. I was taking care of her now, smack in the middle of my 20s, stuck in the proverbial mud of Galveston Bay, building bulkheads and taking care of my mother. Over the years, Terry and Diane had been building their life up in Houston. Terry met a man named Gary, and we would see them a few times a year and spend some weekends with them. And I recall having some spiritual conversations, but like you mentioned, I was always argumentative, even in questioning the ethnicity of Jesus. But looking back, Gary was just trying to engage in non-threatening, casual spiritual conversation, but I wasn't ready, and I was more interested in the arguing. I did not recognize it, but this was the beginning of my spiritual journey, as Terry and Gary began to pray for my salvation. Then one of the biggest changes happened in my life. I was set up on a blind date, and when she opened the door, she knew it right away. She met her husband, her future husband. I didn't really have to do anything because she knew it. She fell in love with me instantly. She saw the house, the picket fence, the dogs, the 3.5 kids, the whole nine yards. And eventually, I said yes to her proposals. That could have happened, right? It was evident we were not cut from the same cloth. Tara is straight-laced, a rule follower. Has anybody played board games with her? So you know what I'm talking about. Zachary just got out of therapy from a sequence issue with Mom. So, combine Tara's values with my loose lifestyle, recipe for success, right there. Soon after we were married, we packed up and moved to Colorado, literally with all my baggage in tow. Tara knew I was a drinker, but she had no idea to what extent until we were living together and working together. And that's not a lie. Cubicle to cubicle, I could hear her voice 24/7. If that's not proof God exists, I don't know. My habit began to increase quickly and aggressively, and this was not the Little House on the Prairie movie Tara had envisioned in her mind. 2 years in, and our marriage being tested and divorce being an option, one day she turned to me and she said, "I'm ready to move back home." And of course, I was totally oblivious. Thankfully, God had orchestrated Terry and Gary to come up for a skiing trip. And this was the first chance I got to spend some time with Gary. And I saw someone who seemed happy and confident and gracious, but strong, loving, but seemed to be worryless. It was like a breath of fresh air I needed. As I mentioned, Terry and Gary had been praying for me for a long time. And while on our ski trip, I felt compelled to ask a lot of spiritual questions. Looking back, I had become awakened, and I was searching. And while driving back from skiing, I had a spiritual conversation and finally ran out of questions. And Gary turned to me and he said, "You just come down to your will, Scott. That's what's holding you back from putting your faith in Christ." And Terry is in the back of the van listening to us. The next day, Gary and I returned the rental van. And I told Gary that I was ready and my will was ready. So we pulled over on the side of the highway. And it was God's plan. That on the side of the highway in nowhere, Colorado, I gave my life to Christ. I admitted I could not do it without him, and I come to accept and believe that Jesus is the one and only Son of God and came to this earth and was crucified on a cross for my sins and died. And on the third day, he rose to new life from the grave, and as it's recorded and seen by his disciples and 500, at least 500 other people. It's proof that he resurrected from the dead. I recall a sense of blackness lifting at that moment, and I could literally take a deep breath. And I looked outside, and I had been driving by the mountains for 2 years, and I'd never seen them more beautiful. And it was like Bob Ross, right there, little happy trees. We returned home, and I told Tara what happened, and while she stood there in bewilderment and with her mouth aghast, I told her we were moving back home. We had no plan. We had no money. We had no idea of finding a house in Houston, so we moved in with Tara and Gary. Why was this so clear to me? I didn't want to be a ship on the water without an anchor. I needed a compass and someone who knew how to read the maps, a spiritual parent, and hopefully Gary would have been would be mine. The sense of knowing what I needed was so strong for me, I later recognized the feeling I had around Gary was that of structure and order. I wanted to get in the same slot he was in. In racing, sometimes a slower car gets behind a faster one, and he will begin to draft behind that car. Sometimes to save gas, sometimes to slingshot around to the finish line, because my car was sputtering, and I was not going to make it to the finish line. Gary and I started to meet and go through Operation Timothy, which began to provide an understanding of a life with God through Jesus. After several months of living with them, we moved out on our own, and I thought my drinking and loose lifestyle was contained. However, during the next few years, we struggled. We were blessed with the birth of Abigail and soon Caleb, and the whole women can't get pregnant while they're nursing. Yeah, that's not true. That's just simply not true. After we got the air under our sails with two infants, I got a good job in telecommunications. I even started meeting with the small group in the mornings to memorize and discuss scripture. Tara was able to be home with the kids just like we wanted. I had become dogmatic about my drinking, and we were on a smooth path for a while. Things were going good, especially spiritually. I was slipstreaming. I was right behind Gary, right where I thought I wanted to be, and I thought I was going in the right direction. If this was a car race, this would be the midpoint. Right where you get nestled in, and you start to relax, because it's a long way to go. You become comfortable. There's no need to panic as long as you keep up some maintenance to the car. Check in with the pit crew. You should be able to make it. Let's settle in for the ride. That's an understatement. This is where Lightning McQueen begins to drift off the highway unknowingly. We finally move into our house of our own, and we are introduced to a whole new level of stress. I met and began hanging out with some guys from the neighborhood, and they didn't have bad intentions, but their influence began to pull me ever so gently down the wrong road. The boundaries I had set for myself regarding my drinking started to loosen. I was becoming lazy with my relationship with God and not making it a priority. The root of my anxiety was still there. The evil one began to slightly water the seeds of my addiction. The kids were getting older, and each phase of them was often a struggle for me because I had no roadmap into parenting. It was like throwing a dart on a dartboard. Bam! That didn't work. That makes scar. But let's see what happens next. Throw another one. Didn't work. Just didn't work, didn't work. Kept trying stuff. Just more and more stress and not getting the results that I wanted. But the race didn't stop. The kids became very active in school and extracurriculars, and I did not want the kids to feel the same lack of presence with me as I did with my mother. And with the absence of my father, I felt like I needed to overcompensate for the father role as well. I wanted to be so present that I was overbearing. The daily stress of making sure my family did not follow in my footsteps was overwhelming. I was literally on the same curve as Lightning McQueen. And at this point, the gravity of my anxiety was just pulling me in that direction, literally without any effort. I was drinking more and more heavily now, which I'm ashamed to admit, because Gary and I were meeting weekly at Starbucks. And he noticed it, and he told me I had a problem. And it would potentially destroy my marriage. But like Pacino, I acted my way through that, all the while sitting there thinking which liquor store was closer on the way home. Eventually, we stopped meeting. I was drunk almost every weekend now. Remember what I said earlier, the cliffhanger. A divorce decree was found between my mother and father. My mother had lied to me for 30 years about his death. And after the shock of finding out, I wanted to see if he was still alive. And I found him living in Louisiana. I wanted to reach out to him and talk to him. But this was not your, do you have life insurance phone call on a Tuesday night. I thought I was prepared for rejection, so I willed up the courage and I called. But he would not come to the phone because he did not believe it was me. He did not want to talk. Having my fear realized in that moment, what I heard was he did not want to take responsibility. He did not want to answer my questions. He didn't want to be a man. He didn't want to be my father. So yeah, that went well. I put all that hurt in my safe, and I continually changed the combination so that it would never come out. This would be the part of the movie where Lightning McQueen is now awake, on the wrong road, heading down the wrong direction, and actually sped up. That's exactly what I did. It had been years completing Operation Timothy, and I wanted to meet with the man on my own, and I prayed about it, and I wanted a spiritual life with God and Jesus, but Jesus was responding with, did you eat the cookie on the counter? And I'm sitting here wiping crumbs from my face. Like, really? He's not going to give that to me, because alcohol was my God, and it consumed me. And one Saturday, I decided to call Mom and confront her about the divorce and lying to me. That conversation did not go well either. She fell right back into her victim role, deflecting and placing blame. No comfort to me. No apologies. I hung up the phone and struggling with the fact that I will never get answers. I may never get answers. A few months later, I get a call that she was rushed to the hospital. I get there and she was dead. They put me in a room alone, and the anxiety of waiting for the car to turn down the road came rushing back. Alcohol had taken over my life completely at this point. My walk with Jesus had stopped. My marriage was clinging to a thread. There were really bad times, and really, really, really bad times. Especially when you can't spell the alphabet correctly in front of a police officer. I was arrested one night for DUI, taken to county jail. And I felt like that lizard that could look at two things at once. Looking at the clock and looking at me. I just knew when I was released, Tara would be walking down with divorce papers in her hand. You don't understand the picture of love until you see her in downtown Houston with her arms open, smiling at me, being released from 12 hours in jail. $20 goes to anyone who knows what I did next. You think things would have changed after that? And for a couple of years, it was slightly better, slightly being an understatement. I spent the next 10 years viewing life through a bottle. In 2020, Abigail was accepted to a prominent art school in North Carolina. Her being 1,100 miles away was a lot more challenging than I expected. Caleb blew out his knee in his first basketball practice of his senior year, and we were hoping that he would be given an opportunity to play some level of college ball. So stress and anxiety was at an all-time high. With alcohol getting in the way of my relationship with God, I didn't know how to handle these potential life-changing events. So I drank. Heavy and often. It was so much easier for me not to feel the pain. This was not the Little House on the Prairie movie that I had in my mind. I could tell Tara was at the end of her rope. I know she contemplated divorce. Oftentimes she felt trapped, unloved, and made a fool of. She was giving our marriage 100%, and I was not. I had drifted so far off the road. I had no idea where I was until the doctor said there might be an issue with your liver I tried to quit drinking several times, going to AA meetings. I would sit there and listen to people talk about how bad they had it, extended stints in the hospital, jail, families completely broken, and I would sit there in a dungeon of my own doing. I cannot express how exhausting it was. I would wake up at 7 in the morning and immediately plan my day around drinking. What are we doing today? How can I fit it in? Where would Tara and the kids be? How will I hide it? How will I lie about it? I need to plan it right so she won't find out. Will I be driving? I can't get drunk too early. Will there be a store nearby? What responsibilities do I have today? I should stop drinking. I need to be healthy. Tara needs me to be around. The kids need to be around. The doctor told me to stop. Do I want to be one of those people in the meetings? Do I want to go to jail again? And all of that before 7:02. I look back at my life and I can see all the road signs, the guardrails, those stupid wake-up bumps. I believe God was trying to get my attention, and I had fallen asleep and drifted off my course. I was lazy, comfortable, sloth-like. And when things started to get difficult, I gave in to my own evil desires, just like James 1:14-15 say. I gave up and took the victim route. You can insert the irony right there if you want. I'd never dealt with my mother and father because I held on to that anger because it gave me some type of emotion towards them. I tried to work through forgiving them, even meeting with Gary a couple of times, but when it got hard, I would stop. It was that whoopee blanket of blame that I had towards them that was comforting. Up until then, there was complete silence between me and God and Jesus. Alcohol made it difficult, impossible to have a relationship with them. And the devil did his job, man. He just left me to my vices. He was no longer really concerned about me because I posed no threat. About a year and a half ago, I started to meet. With three of my closest friends in a Bible study. One of them is here today. This was truly God-driven because two of the guys I'd previously asked to go through Operation Timothy, and God, knowing that I was not in the right space, he didn't allow it. But now we were in his word. This began to slowly awaken my spirit, gave me time to stop chasing my tail. Then about a year ago, I received concerning news about my liver. I went for a checkup, and my blood work was a wreck. You know it's bad when the doctor comes in and says, "Well, it's been out of whack before, but nothing like this. Enough to give me pause. Pause enough to debate which liquor store to go to on the way home." Insert God here. Just that evening, I received a Facebook message from my friend in Colorado. Him and his family were the first people Tara and I met when we moved there. And I came to find out that he had been in the hospital for several weeks due to alcoholism. I have not talked to him in 4 years, and he reaches out that day. Did I mention the God particle? I found out how bad it really was after his wife called me and told me he'd been in and out of the hospital for months. I talked to him about a week later and told him what I was going through. I was completely honest. And we committed to stay in touch and hold each other accountable for drinking. He died 4 days later. With a 24-pack of beer hidden in his car. 2 days later, I was in the emergency room at 1:30, lying on a stretcher waiting for my results. You see, addicts rarely hit rock bottom. It's always a moving target. I thought my arrest would be rock bottom. I thought ruining a family vacation because I was drunk the entire time. I thought sitting outside a liquor store waiting for them to open would be rock bottom. That one Halloween where I lied to Tara and told her I was going home to use the restroom and I took a couple of shots and passed out, stranding my family too far away to walk home and them not knowing what happened to me. That would have been rock bottom. Or getting news about my liver. But lying there, I had clarity. I'm not sure if it was being sober for the first time, and I don't know how long, but I knew I didn't belong there. I didn't want to end up like Tim, who died of cirrhosis and pancreatitis, and leave my family in the lurch. I didn't want needles in my arm. I didn't want the sound of those stupid beeping machines. And I don't want the smell of the hospital in my nose anymore. I've always felt like I had something to say. Something within me to show or tell the world. And I was lying there telling myself I have Jesus, my wife, my kids, and this life. This is it, man. There's no do-overs like in kickball. Unfortunately, there's no exchange policy for the cards you get. And I didn't want to be known for the guy that had alcohol conquer him. I was walking our dogs a few days later, and I was after being released from the ER, and I started to think about Mom and Dad, Tim, and death. And being so utterly exhausted, playing victim role with my life, and knowing this is most of my doing, and unlike other God moments in my life, which were palpable, this was like he grabbed my hand and he stopped me, and he said, "I'll never stop loving you. But I've given you all the signs, even those stupid wake-up bumps." I drifted off course, and the silence was so loud right there. I knew what I needed to do. And like a ship creeping out of the fog, where it's ominous but poetic and beautiful at the same time, I knew I had to get busy living or get busy dying. You see, I had stopped my walk with God for so long. I was afraid to admit to him everything I was doing and did, and all the hurt that I caused. My mind went first to the people around me, the ones that I immediately hurt. But standing there, I felt an overwhelming sadness that I did the same thing to him. The lies, the drunkenness. He died for me. I felt foolish and ashamed. I told him how sorry I was and that I loved him, and that I was thankful that he kept me alive, and I asked him to forgive me. I felt the weight being lifted, but it wasn't completely off. I needed to admit to Tara everything, and I did. I reached out to Tara and Gary to ask for prayer to help me overcome this huge hurdle. I've come to the realization that my life is my life. It's my cards. It's the cards I was dealt. In my own way, I have come to forgive my mother and father. When I was drinking, I always thought that it had to be some spectacle to forgive them. Sacrificing a calf or a bonfire or war paint on the face or something stupid. But it's not. It's personal. I was holding on to that anger because it was power over them. But coming out of the fog, I see two people. Mom and Dad that had their own issues. I'm sure if you asked him, he did not want to abandon me. And I'm sure if you ask her, she would say she tried her hardest. I've come to accept that, and I have forgiven them. And I would tell them that I love them. Does it still hurt? Absolutely. But it wasn't the House on the Prairie life that they signed up for either. And I know God loves them. I was on that walk and I was awakened, and I found that I drifted off my path from God down a proverbial road into the desert, somewhere I should not have been. It took me years to get there, and it's a long road back. I'm dealing with the damage that I've done, and I've asked the people to forgive me. And I know my battle's not over. I'm not delusional enough to think that. It will never be. But if I keep my eyes on the prize, specifically Philippians 3:14, I press on towards the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Jesus Christ. If I remain focused and committed on a daily basis, I'm sure I'll have an immeasurable chance at success. I know my salvation was always secure. I was always secure in Jesus because his life is death and resurrection. Even though I turned my back on God and Jesus, they never abandoned me. Romans 8, 37 and 39. No. No, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I'm convinced that neither death nor life, nor angels or demons, nor the present or the future, or any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all of creation will separate you from the love of God. There's so much peace in that verse. I'm so thankful that I can't express it. I don't have the words. I love you so much. Look out for bobcats behind you. Thank you. I appreciate you.
Scott, thank you so much. That was a very powerful testimony, and thank you for staying close to Christ and continuing to pursue him. So it's a little awkward to go into announcements after that, but that's, I think, what I'm supposed to do. So, find the best one to start with. Tomorrow morning, it's going to be sharing time. We start at 10:15, right after share groups come into the main hall. We'd have that set up where we can have some time to share any stories and experiences and movements that we've had here at Mo Ranch in our lives. And we'll repeat this tomorrow, but we're interested in what way God's moved us here while we've been together in his community, and how he's impacted us while we're here at Mo. So we'd like to keep the focus on that. A couple other things. Don't forget there's pre-registration forms. Those will be on the book table back in the main hall. And again, if you're interested in coming next year, please fill that out. And then it's a $150 deposit for next year's ticket here. This evening, we do have ice cream at the Wagon Wheel. It's always fun, so please grab the kids and come on down. I guess that's after 8 o'clock pickup. Is that correct? At 9 o'clock we'll be down there? Okay, so 9 o'clock at the Wagon Wheel. Today, a little lighter or more serious note, it's pickleball, 1:30. So please show up prepared for that, because I'm not good, but I plan to be prepared. Oh, and last, if we could all come down for the group photo. Did I miss anything? We're good? Okay. So please come down slowly, make your way down, and we want some of the height-challenged people to be up on this wall right here, and also don't step back too far, and we'll work around the tall people, John Patchell.